and manage my own affairs, she said with some heat. Gee, I said, and noticed that the blood had mounted a little in her cheeks. I thought you and Adam were always just like that. And I held my right hand up with forefinger and the next one side by side. We are, she said, but I don't care what... And you don't care what he... And I jerked a thumb toward the high, unperturbed, marmoreal face which gazed from the massy gold frame in the shadow. Would say about it either, huh? Oh, Jack. And she rose from the couch, almost fretful in her motion, which wasn't like her. What makes you talk like that? Can't you see? I'm just getting the money for the home. It's a piece of business. Just business. She jerked her chin up with a look that was supposed to settle the matter, but succeeded in unsettling me. Listen, I said, and felt myself getting hot under the collar. Business or not, it's worth your reputation to be caught running around with... Running round, running round, she exclaimed. Don't be a fool. I had lunch with him on business. Business or not, it's worth your reputation and... Reputation, she said. I'm old enough to take care of my reputation. You just told me I was nearly senile. I said you were nearly 35, I said, factually. Oh, Jack, she said, I am, and I haven't done anything. I don't do anything, not anything worth anything. She wavered there, and with a hint of distraction, lifted her hands to touch her hair. Not anything. I don't want to play bridge all the time, and what little I do, that home, the playground thing. There's always the junior league, I said, but she ignored it. That's not enough. Why didn't I do something, study something, be a doctor, a nurse? I could have been Adam's assistant. I could have studied landscape gardening. I could have... You could make lampshades, I said. I could have done something. Something. You could have got married, I said. You could have married me. Oh, I don't mean just getting married. I mean... You don't know what you mean, I said. Oh, Jack, she said, and reached out and took my hand and hung on to it. Maybe I don't. I don't know what's wrong with me tonight. When I come out here sometimes, I'm happy when I come, I truly am, but then... She didn't say any more about it. By this time, she had sunk her head to my chest, and I had given her a few comforting pats on the shoulder, and she'd said in a muffled sort of way that I had to be her friend, and I had said, sure, and had caught some good whiffs of the way her hair smelled. It smelled just the way it always had, a good, clean, well-washed, little girl ready for a party smell. But she wasn't a little girl, and this wasn't a party. It definitely was not a party. With pink ice cream and devil's food cake and horns to blow, and we all played clap in and clap out, and the game in which you sang about King William being King James' son, and down on this carpet you must kneel sure as the grass grows in the field and choose the one you love best. She stood there for a minute or two with her head on my chest, and you could have seen daylight between her and her friend, if there had been any daylight, while her friend gave her the impersonal and therapeutic pats on the shoulder. Then she walked away from him and stood by the hearth, looking down at the fire, which was doing fine now and making the room look what is called real homey. Then the front door swung open and the wind off the cold sea whipped into the room like a great dog shaking itself, and the fire leaped. It was Adam Stanton coming into that homey atmosphere. He had an armful of packages, for he'd been down into the landing to get our provisions. Hello, he said over the packages, and smiled out of that wide, thin, firm mouth, which in repose looked like a clean, well-healed surgical wound, but which, when he smiled, if he smiled, surprised you and made you feel warm. Look here, I said quick, way back yonder, any time. Was Judge Irwin ever broke? Bad broke?
Why, no. I don't know,
he began, his face shading. Anne swung round to look at him, and then sharply at me. I thought for an instant she was about to say something, but she didn't.
Why, yes,
Adam said, standing there, still hugging the parcels. I had speared it up from the deep mud.
Why, yes,
he repeated, with the pleased bright look on his face, which people get when they dredge up any lost thing from the past.
Yes, let me see. I was just a kid, about 1913 or 1914. I remember Father saying something about it to Uncle John or somebody before he remembered I was in the room. Then the judge was here, and he and Father... I thought they were having a row. Their voices got so high. They were talking about money.
Thanks, I said.
Welcome, he said, with a slightly puzzled smile on his face, and moved to the couch to let the parcels cascade to the safe softness.
Well, Anne said, looking at me, you might at least have the grace to tell him why you asked that question.
Sure, I said, and I turned to Adam. I wanted to find out for Governor Stark.
Politics, he said, and the jaw closed like a trap.
Yes, politics,
Anne said, smiling a little sourly.
Well, thank God I don't have to mess with him, Adam said. Nowadays, anyway.
But he said it almost lightly, which surprised me, then added,
What the hell if Stark knows about the judge being broke? It was more than 20 years ago, and there's no law against being broke. What the hell?
Yeah, what the hell?
Anne said, and looking at me, gave that not unsour smile.
And what the hell are you doing?
Adam demanded, laughing, and grabbed her by the arm and shook her.
Standing there when the grub needs cooking. Get the lead out, sourpuss, and get going.
He shoved her toward the couch where the packages were heaped. She bent to scoop up a lot of packages, and he whacked her across the backsides and said,
Get going,
and laughed. And she laughed, too, with pleasure, and everything was forgotten. For it wasn't often that Adam opened up and laughed a lot. And then he could be free and gay, and you knew you would have a wonderful time. We had a wonderful time. While Anne cooked and I fixed drinks and set the table, Adam snatched the sheet off the piano. They kept the thing in tune out there, and it wasn't a bad one even yet, and beat the hell out of it till the house bulged and rocked. He even took 3 good highballs before dinner instead of 1. Then we ate, and he beat on the piano some more, playing stuff like Roses Are Blooming in Picardy and 3 o'clock in the Morning, while Anne and I danced and cavorted, or he'd mush it up and Anne would hum in my ear and we'd sway sweet and slow like young poplars in the slightest breeze. Then he jumped up from the piano bench whistling Beautiful Lady, snatched her out of my arms and swung her wide in a barrel house waltz while she leaned back on his arm with her head back and eyes closed for a swoon, and with right arm outstretched held delicately the hem of her fluttering skirt. But Adam was a good dancer, even clowning. It was because he was a natural, for he never got any practice anymore, and never had taken his share, not of anything except work, and he could have had them crawling to him and asking for it. And once in about 5 years he would break out in a kind of wild, free, exuberant gaiety, like a levee break streaming out to snatch the trees and brush up by the roots, and you would be the trees and brush, you and everybody around him. His eyes would gleam wild, and he'd gesture wide with an excess of energy bursting from deep inside. You would think of a great turbine or dynamo making 1,000,000 revs a minute and boiling out the power and about to jump loose from its moorings. When he gestured with those strong, long, supple white hands, it was a mixture of Svengali and an atom-busting machine. You expected to see blue sparks. When he got like that, they wouldn't have had the strength to crawl to him and ask for it. They would just be ready to fall back and roll over where they were. Only it didn't do them any good. But that didn't come often, and didn't last long. The cold would settle down and the lid would go on right quick. Adam didn't have the power on that night. He was just ready to smile and laugh and joke and beat the piano and swing his sister in the barrel house waltz while the fire leaped on the big hearth and the high face gazed down from the massy gold frame, and the wind moved in off the sea and in the dark outside clashed the magnolia leaves. Not that in that room, with the fire crackling and the music, we heard the tiny clashing of the magnolia leaves the wind made. I heard it later, in bed, upstairs in the dark, through the open window, the tiny, dry clashing of the leaves, and thought, Were we happy tonight because we were happy, or because once, a long time back, we had been happy? Was our happiness tonight like the light of the moon, which does not come from the moon, for the moon is cold and has no light of its own, but is reflected light from far away? I turned that notion around in my head and tried to make a nice, tidy little metaphor out of it, but the metaphor wouldn't work out, for you have to be the cold, dead, wandering moon, and you have to have been the sun, too, way back, and how the hell can you be both the sun and the moon? It was not consistent, it was not tidy. To hell with it, I thought, listening to the leaves. Then thought, Well, anyway, I know now Irwin was broke. I had dug that much up out of the past, and tomorrow I would leave Burden's Landing and the past and go back to the present. So I went back to the present, which was Tiny Duffy sitting in a great soft leather chair with his great soft hams flowing over the leather and his great soft belly flowing over his great soft hams and a long cigarette holder with a burning cigarette stuck jauntily out from one side of his face. The cigarette holder was a recent innovation, imitated from a gentleman who was the most prominent member of the political party to which Tiny Duffy gave his allegiance, and his great soft face flowing down over his collar and a diamond ring on his finger, big as a walnut. For all of that was Tiny Duffy, who was not credible but true and who had obviously consulted the cartoons by Harper's Weekly in the files of the 90s to discover exactly what the successful politician should be, do, and wear. Which was Tiny Duffy saying, "Jesus, and the boss gonna put $6 million in a hospital. $6 million. And lying back in the chair, eyes dreamily on the coffered ceiling, head wreathed in the baby blue smoke from the cigarette, murmuring dreamily, $6 million. And Sadie Burke saying, "Yeah, $6 million, and he ain't planning for you to get your fingers on a penny of it." I could fix it up for him in the 4th District. McMurphy still got it sewed up down there, him and Gummy Lawson. But throw that hospital contract to Gummy and... And Gummy would sell out McMurphy, is that it? Well, now, I wouldn't put it that way. Gummy'd sort of talk reason into McMurphy, you might say. And would sort of slip you a slice, is that it, Tiny? I ain't talking about me, I'm talking about Gummy. He'd handle McMurphy for the boss. The boss don't need anybody to handle McMurphy. He'll handle McMurphy when the time comes, and it'll be permanent. For God's sake, Tiny, you've known the boss as long as you have, and you still don't know him. Don't you know he'd rather bust a man than buy him? Wouldn't he, Jack? How do I know? I said. But I did know. At least I knew that the boss was out to bust a man named Judge Irwin, and I was elected to do the digging. So I went back to the digging. But the next day, before I got back at the digging, a call came from Ann Stanton.
"Smarty," she said, "Smarty, you thought you were smart."
I heard her laughing way off somewhere at the end of the line, but the tingling came over the wire, and I thought of her face laughing.
"Yes, Smarty, you found out from Adam how Judge Irwin was broke a long time ago, but I've found out something, too."
"Yeah?" I said.
"Yeah, Smarty. I went to see old cousin Matilda, who knows everything about everybody, for 100 years back. I just got to talking about Judge Irwin, and she began to talk. You just mentioned something, and it's like putting a nickel in a music box. Yes, Judge Irwin was broke, or near it then, but... And the joke's on you, Jackie boy, it's on you, Smarty boy, and on your boss." And there was the laughter again, coming from far away, coming out of the little black tube in my hand. "Yeah?" I said.
"Then he got married," she said.
"Who?" I said.
"Who are we talking about, Smarty? Judge Irwin got married."
"Sure he was married. Everybody knew he was married, but what the hell is that?"
"He married money. Cousin Matilda says so, and she knows everything. He was broke, but he married money. Now, Smarty, put that in your pipe and smoke it."
"Thanks," I said. But before it was out of my mouth, I heard a clicking sound, and she'd hung up. I lighted a cigarette and leaned back in the swivel chair and swung my feet up to the desk. Sure, everybody knew or had known that Judge Irwin was married. Judge Irwin, in fact, had been married twice. The first woman, the woman he was married to when I was a little boy, had been thrown from a horse and couldn't do more than lie up in bed and stare at the ceiling or, on her good days, out the window. But she had died when I was just a kid, and I scarcely remembered her. But you almost forgot the other wife, too. She was from far away. I tried to remember how she looked. I'd seen her several times, all right. But a kid of 15 or so doesn't pay much attention to a grown woman. I called up an image of a dark, thin woman with big, dark eyes, wearing a long white dress and carrying a white parasol. Maybe it wasn't the right image at all. Maybe it was somebody else who had been married to Judge Irwin and had come to Burden's Landing and had received all the curious, smiling ladies in Judge Irwin's long white house, and had been aware of the eyes and the sudden silence for attention, and then the new sibilance as she walked down the aisle in St. Matthew's just before the services began, and had fallen sick and had lived with a Negro nurse in an upstairs room for so long that people forgot about her very existence and were surprised when the funeral came to remind them of the fact that she had existed. But after the funeral, there was nothing to remind them, for the body had gone back to whatever place it was she came from, and not even a chiseled name was left in the Irwin plot in the St. Matthew's graveyard, under the oaks and the sad poetic festoons of Spanish moss, which were garlanded on the boughs as though to prepare for the festivities of ghosts. The judge had had bad luck with his wives, and people felt sorry for him. Both of them sickly for a long time, and then had died on his hands. He got a lot of sympathy for that. But his second wife, I was told, was rich. That explained why the face I called up was not pretty, not the kind of face you would expect to find on Judge Irwin's wife, but a sallowish, thin face, not even young, with only the big dark eyes to recommend it. So she had been rich, and that disposed of my notion that back in 1913 or 1914, the judge had been broke and had stepped over the line. And that made Ann Stanton happy. Happy because now Adam hadn't played, even unwittingly, stool pigeon to the boss. Well, if it made her happy, it made me happy too, I reckoned. And maybe she was happy to think, too, that Judge Irwin was innocent. Well, that would have made me happy too. All I was doing was trying to prove Judge Irwin innocent. I would be able, sooner or later, to go to the boss and say, "No sale, boss. He's washed in the blood." "The son of a bitch is washed in whitewash," the boss would say. But he'd have to take my word, for he knew I was thorough. I was a very thorough and well-trained research student. And truth was what I sought without fear or favor, and let the chips fly. Anyway, I could cross 1913 off the ticket. Ann Stanton had settled that. Or had she? When you're looking for the lost will in the old mansion, you tap inch by inch along the beautiful mahogany wainscoting or along the massive stonework of the cellarage and listen for the hollow sound. Then, upon hearing it, you seek the secret button or insert the crowbar. I had tapped and had heard something hollow. Judge Irwin had been broke. "But oh no," Ann Stanton had said. "There's no secret hiding place there. That's just where the dumbwaiter goes." But I tapped again, just to listen to that hollow sound, even if it were just the place where the dumbwaiter went. I asked myself, if a man needs money, where does he get it? And the answer is easy, he borrows it. And if he borrows it, he has to give security. What would Judge Irwin have given as security? Most likely his house in Burden's Landing or his plantation up the river. If it was big dough he needed, it would be the plantation. So I got in my car and headed up the river for Mortonville, which is the county seat of LaSalle County, a big chunk of which is the old Irwin plantation where the cotton grows white as whipped cream and the happy darkies sing all day like Al Jolson. In the courthouse at Mortonville, I got hold of the abstract on the Irwin place. There it was, from the 18th century Spanish grant to the present moment. And in 1907 there was the entry, "Mortgage, Montague Irwin to Mortonville Mercantile Bank, $42,000, due January 1st, 1910. Late in January 1910, a chunk had been paid, about $12,000, and the mortgage redrawn. By the middle of 1912, interest payments were being passed. In March 1914, foreclosure proceedings had been instituted. But the judge had been saved by the bell. In early May, there was an entry for the satisfaction of the mortgage in full. No further entries were on the abstract. I had tapped again, and there was the hollow sound. When a man is broke, there's always a hollow sound, like the tomb. But he had married a rich wife. But was she rich? I had only the word of old Cousin Matilda for that, and the evidence of Mrs. Irwin's sallow face. I decided to put in the crowbar. I would check the date of marriage with the dates on the abstract. That might tell something. But whatever that said, I would put in the crowbar. I knew nothing about Mrs. Irwin, not the date of her marriage, not even her name or where she came from. But that was easy. An hour in the newspaper files of the public library back in the city, looking at the society pages, which after more than 20 years were yellow and crumbling and somewhat less than gay or grand, and I came out again into the light of day with my collar wilted and my hands begrimed, but with the words scribbled on the back of an envelope in my inside coat pocket, Mabel Carruthers, only child of Lemoyne Carruthers, Savannah, Georgia, married January 12th, 1914. The date of marriage didn't tell me much. True, the foreclosure proceedings had been instituted after the marriage, but that didn't prove that Mabel wasn't rich. It might have taken the judge all the honeymoon to work around to the gross subject of the long green. The judge would not have been crude, so she might have been rich as goose grease. But nevertheless, that night I was on the train for Savannah. 25 years is not a long time in the eye of God, but it damn near takes the eye of God to spy much about the inside story of even a leading citizen like Lemoyne Carruthers, who has been dead 25 years. I didn't have the eye of God. I had to poke and pry and work newspaper files and pump the broken-down old bird who was city editor and cultivate the society of a fellow I had once known who was now a local hotshot in the insurance game and get to know his friends. I ate roast ducks stuffed with oysters and yams and that wonderful curry they make in Savannah, which tastes good even to a man like me who loathes food, and drank rye whiskey and walked down those beautiful streets General Oglethorpe laid out, and stared at the beautiful severe fronts of the houses, which were more severe than ever now, for the last leaves were off the arching trees of the streets, and it was the season when the wind blows great chunks of gray sky in off the Atlantic, which come dragging in so low their bellies brush the masts and chimney pots, like gravid sows crossing a stubble field. I saw the Lemoyne Carruthers house. The old boy must have been rich, all right, and when he died in 1904 he had been rich, according to the probate of the will. But it was 9 years between 1904 and 1913, and a lot can happen. Mabel Carruthers had lived high, that was the story, but they all said she could afford it, and according to what I could pick up, there was no reason to believe that the uncle in New York, who was the executor of the will, hadn't known his business about handling Mabel's investments. It looked absolutely level, but there's one thing you must never forget: the judgment docket book in the courthouse. I did not forget it, and there I found the name of Mabel Carruthers. People had had some trouble getting money out of Mabel, but this didn't prove anything. Lots of rich girls are so rich they're just above paying bills, and you have to pinch them to make them disgorge. But I noticed one thing. Mabel didn't get the bad habit until 1911. In other words, she had paid her bills all right for the first 7 years she had had her money. Now, I argued, if this amiable failing had been merely the result of temperament and not of necessity, why did it come on her all at once? It had come on her all at once and in a flock. Not that it was the corner grocer by himself. He had some fast company, for Mabel didn't like to pay Leclerc in New York for a diamond pendant, and didn't like to pay her dressmaker, and didn't like to pay a local vintner for some pretty impressive stuff. Mabel had lived high, all right. The last judgment was to the Seaboard Bank for a loan amounting to $750, small change for Mabel. Now, there was no Seaboard Bank in Savannah. The telephone directory told me that, but an old fella sitting in a split-bottom chair in the courthouse told me that the Seaboard Bank had been bought out by the Georgia Fidelity back about 1920. Down at the Georgia Fidelity, they told me. Yes, back in 1920. Who was president of the Seaboard then? Why, just a minute and they'd find out. Mr. Percy Poindexter had been. Was he in Savannah? Well, they couldn't say for sure, times change so fast, but Mr. Pettis would know, Mr. Charles Pettis, who was his son-in-law. Oh, you're welcome, sir, quite welcome. Mr. Percy Poindexter was not in Savannah now, and scarcely in this world, for after the exhalation of each breath, you waited and waited for that delicate little contraption of matchwood and transparent parchment and filigree of blue veins to gather strength enough for one more effort. Mr. Poindexter reclined in his wheelchair, his transparent hands lying on the wine-colored silk of his dressing gown, his pale blue eyes fixed on the metaphysical distance, and breathed each breath, saying,
"Yes, young man, you've lied to me, of course, but I don't care. Care why you want to know. It could not matter now. Not to anyone, for they're all dead. Lemoyne Carruthers is dead. He was my friend, my dearest friend. But that was very long ago, and I do not clearly recollect his face. And his daughter Mabel, I did what I could for her. Even after her financial reverse, she would have had enough to live decently, even in modest luxury. But no, she threw money away. Always more. I loaned her a great deal at the bank. Some of it I shamed her into paying. Two or three notes I paid myself for the memory of Lemoyne, and sent them canceled to her to shame her to discretion. But no, she'd come back to me without shame and stare at me out of her big eyes. They were dark and sullen and hot-looking like a fever, and would say, 'I want money.' And at last I brought a note to judgment to shame her, to frighten her, for her own good. For she spent money like water. She spent it in a fever to give balls and parties, to adorn herself, and she was plain. But she got a husband from the West somewhere, a wealthy man, they said. He married her quickly and took her away. She died and was brought back here. The burial, it was a bad day, and few came, not even in respect to Lemoyne, not even his friends, some of them. Dead 12 years, and they'd forgotten him. People forget."
The breath gave out, and for a long moment I thought there would not be any more. But some more came, and he said,
"But that doesn't matter either."
I thanked him and shook his hand, which was like cold wax and left a chill in my palm, and went out and got into my rented car and drove back to the city, where I got a drink. Not to celebrate, but to take the ice out of my marrow, which not the weather but the old man had put there. I had found out that Mabel Carruthers had been broke, but had married a rich man from the West, or rather what in Savannah they called the West. Well, that was a joke. No doubt the rich man from the West had married her for her money, too. There must have been some gay times as the truth emerged. I left Savannah the next day, but not before I'd gone out to the cemetery to look at the Carruthers' vault, where moss encroached upon the great name and the angel lacked one arm. But that didn't matter, for all the Carruthers's were inside now. I had knocked, and the sound had been very, very hollow. I sunk the crowbar in deeper. Judge Irwin had not paid off his mortgage in 1914 with his wife's money. What had he been doing in 1914 to get money? He'd been running a plantation, and he had been, under Governor Stanton, the state's attorney general. Well, you don't clear $44,000 a season off a cotton plantation. It was that amount he had paid, for the $12,000 he had paid in 1910 had come from a mortgage on the house in the Landing, I discovered, which he cleared at the same time as the plantation. And his salary as attorney general had been $3,400. You don't get rich being an attorney general in a southern state, at least you aren't supposed to. But in March of 1915, the judge had a good job, a very good job. He resigned as attorney general to become counsel and vice president for the American Electric Power Company at a very good figure, $20,000 a year. There was no reason why they shouldn't have hired Judge Irwin, who was a good lawyer, but you could have hired a lot of good lawyers for a lot less than $20,000 a year. But a job in 1915 doesn't pay off the bailiff in 1914. When I knocked, it still sounded hollow. So I took my one plunge in the stock market. One share of common stock of the American Electric Power Company, and it was cheap as dirt in the middle of the Depression. But it turned out to be a very expensive piece of paper for a lot of people. I was a coupon clipper now, and I wanted to know how they were going to take care of my investment. So I took advantage of the stockholder's right. I went down to look at the stock records of the American Electric Power Company. From the literal dust of time, I dug up certain facts. In May 1914, Montague M. Irwin had sold 500 shares of common stock at par to Wilbur Satterfield and Alex Cantor, who were, I was to discover later, officials in the company. That meant Irwin had plenty in his pocket in late May to pay off the mortgages and have some change left over. But when had he got hold of the stock? That was easy. In March 1914, the company had been reorganized, and a big chunk of new stock issued. Irwin's stock was part of the new chunk. The boys had passed it to Irwin, or had he bought it, and some of the other boys had bought it back. Irwin must have kicked himself about selling it, for it began to climb shortly and kept on climbing for quite a spell. Had Messrs. Satterfield and Cantor taken Irwin? They were old hands, on the inside. But Irwin had had to sell, and quick. There was the mortgage. Irwin had had the stock and had sold it to Messrs. Satterfield and Cantor. So far, so good. But how had Irwin got the stock? Had they just given it to him out of the blue? Not likely. But why do people give you great big chunks of nice new stock issues with gold seals? The answer is simple. Because you're nice to them. The job, then, was to find out if Judge Irwin, then state's attorney general, had been nice to the American Electric Power Company. And that meant a long dig, with exactly nothing in the bottom of the hole. For the entire period when Judge Irwin was attorney general, the American Electric Power Company had been an exemplary citizen. It had looked every man in the eye and had asked no favors. There was nothing in the hole. Well, how had Judge Irwin spent his time as attorney general? The usual odds and ends it developed. But there had almost been a case. The suit to recover royalties from the Southern Bell Fuel Company, which had operated under lease the state coal lands. There had been some hullabaloo about it, a little stir in the legislature, and some editorials and some speech-making. But it was only the ghost of a whisper now. I was probably the only person in the state who knew about it now. Unless Judge Irwin knew, and woke up in the night and lay in the dark. It was all about the interpretation of a royalty contract between the state and the company. It was a very ambiguous contract. Perhaps it had been designed to be that way. In any case, by one reading, the state stood to gain about $150,000 in back royalties, and God knew how much before the end of the contract period. But it was a very ambiguous contract. It was so ambiguous that, just as the shooting was about to start, the Attorney General decided that there was no case. "We feel, however," he said in his public statement, "that it is most reprehensible that those responsible for this agreement should have been so lax in their protection of the public interest as to accept the figures of this contract by which the state has sold for a song one of her richest assets. But we also feel that, since the contract exists and is susceptible of only one reasonable interpretation, this state, which wishes to encourage industry and enterprise within her borders, cannot do otherwise than bow to an arrangement which, though obviously unjust in its working, is binding in the law. And we must remember, even in circumstances such as this, that it is by law that justice herself lives." I read that in the Old Times Chronicle of February 26, 1914, which was dated a couple of weeks before the foreclosure proceedings were instituted against the Irwin Plantation, and about 3 weeks before the final reorganization of the American Electric and the issue of the new stock. The relationship was a relationship in time. But is any relationship a relationship in time and only in time? I eat a persimmon and the teeth of a tinker in Tibet are put on edge. The flower in the crannied wall theory. We have to accept it because so often our teeth are on edge from persimmons we didn't eat. So I plucked the flower out of its cranny and discovered an astonishing botanical fact. I discovered that its delicate little root, with many loops and kinks, ran all the way to New York City, where it tapped the lush dung heap called the Madison Corporation. The flower in the cranny was the Southern Bell Fuel Company. So I plucked another little flower called the American Electric Power Company and discovered that its delicate little root tapped the same dung heap. I was not prepared to say that I knew what God and man are, but I was getting ready to make a shrewd guess about a particular man. But just a guess. It was just a guess for a long time, for I had reached the stage in my problem where there was nothing to do but pray. That stage always comes. You do all you can, and you pray till you can't pray, and then you go to sleep and hope to see it all in the dream by grace. Kubla Khan, the benzene ring, Cadman's song, they all came in the dream. It came to me, just as I fell asleep one night. It was only a name, a funny name. Mortimer L. Littlepaw. The name drifted around inside my head, and I thought how funny it was, and went to sleep. But when I woke up in the morning, my first thought was, Mortimer L. Littlepaw. Then walking down the street that day, I bought a newspaper, and as I looked at it, I saw the name Mortimer L. Littlepaw, only it was not in the newspaper I had just bought. It was on a yellow, crumbling, old cheese-smelling sheet, which I saw suddenly in my mind's eye. Mortimer L. Littlepaw's death accident, coroner's jury decides. That was it. Then, wavering slowly up, like a chunk of waterlogged wood stirred loose from the depth, the phrase came, Counsel for the American Electric Power Company. That was it.
This ends Disc 9. All the King's Men, Disc 10.
I went back to the files and found the story. Mortimer had fallen out of a hotel window, or rather, off the little iron-railed balcony outside the window. He had fallen from the fifth floor, and that was the end of Mortimer. At the inquest, his sister, who lived with him, said he had recently been in ill health and had complained of fits of dizziness. There had been some theory of suicide, for Mortimer's affairs were in a tangled condition, it developed, and the railing was high for an accidental fall, and there was a little mystery about a letter a bellhop swore Mortimer had given him the evening before his death, with a 4-bit tip and instructions to go out and mail it immediately. The bellhop swore it had been addressed to Miss Littlepaw. Miss Littlepaw swore that she had received no letter. Well, Mortimer had been dizzy. He had also been a lawyer for the American Electric. He had, I learned, been let out not long before Irwin came in. It didn't sound too promising, but one more dead end wouldn't matter. There'd been plenty of dead ends in the 6 or 8 months I'd been on the job. But this was not a dead end. There was Miss Lily May Littlepaw, whom, after 5 weeks, I tracked down to a dark, foul, fox-smelling lair in a rooming house on the edge of the slums in Memphis. She was a gaunt old woman, wearing black spotted and stained with old food, almost past the pretense of gentility, blinking slowly at me from weak red eyes set in the age-crusted face, sitting there in the near-dark room, exuding her old fox smell, which mixed with the smell of oriental incense and candle wax. There were holy pictures on the walls on every spare space, and in one corner of the room, on a little table, a sort of shrine, with a curtain of faded wine-colored velvet hanging above it, and inside not a Madonna or crucifix, as you would expect from the other pictures, but a big image made of felt and mounted on a board, which I at first took to be a sunflower pincushion swollen to an impractical size, but then realized was an image of the sun and its rays, the life-giver. And in that room, before it on the table, a candle burned fatly as though fed not merely from the wax but from the substance of the greasy air. In the middle of the room was a table with a wine-colored velvet cover, and on the table a dish of poisonously colored hard candies, a glass of water, and a couple of long, narrow horns or trumpets apparently made of pewter. I sat well back from the table. On the other side, Miss Littlepaw studied me from the red eyes, then said in a voice surprisingly strong, "Shall we begin?" She continued to study me, then said, half as though to herself, "If Mrs. Dalzell sent you, I reckon—" She sent me. She had sent me. It had cost me $25. "I reckon it's all right." "It's all right," I said. She got up and went to the candle on the little table, watching me all the while as though, in the last flicker of the light before she blew it out, I might turn out to be distinctly not all right. Then she blew out the candle and made her way back to her chair. After that, there were wheezings and meanings for a bit, the chink of metal, which I took to be from one of the trumpets, some conversation, not very enlightening or edifying, from Princess Spotted Deer, who was Miss Littlepaw's control, and some even more unenlightening remarks, given in a husky guttural, from somebody on the other side who claimed to be named Jimmy and to have been a friend of my youth. Meanwhile, the radiator against the wall at my back thumped and churned, and I inhaled the pitch darkness and sweated. Jimmy was saying that I was going to take a trip. I leaned forward in the dark and said, "Ask for Mortimer. I want to ask Mortimer a question." One of the trumpets chinked softly again, and the princess made a remark I didn't catch. "It's Mortimer L. I want," I said. There was some huskiness in the trumpet, very indistinct. "He is trying to come through," Miss Littlepaw's voice said, "but the vibrations are bad." "I want to ask him a question," I said. "Get Mortimer. You know, Mortimer L. The L is for Lonzo." The vibrations were still bad. "I want to ask him about the suicide." The vibrations must have been very bad, for there wasn't a sound now. "Get Mortimer," I said. "I want to ask him about the insurance. I want to ask him about the last letter he wrote." The vibrations must have been terrific, for a trumpet banged on the table and bounced off to the floor, and there was a racket and rustling across the table. And when the electric light came suddenly on, there was Miss Littlepaw standing by the door with her hand on the switch, staring at me out of the red eyes while her breath hissed quite audibly over old teeth.
"You lied," she said. "You lied to me."
"No, I didn't lie to you," I said. "My name is Jack Burden, and Mrs. Dalzell sent me."
"She's a fool," she hissed. "A fool to send you. You..."
She thought I was all right, and she wasn't a fool to want $25. I took out my wallet, removed some bills, and held them in my hand. "I may not be all right," I said, "but this stuff always is."
"What do you want?"
she demanded, her eyes snatching from my face to the green sheaf and back to my face. "What I said," I said. "I want to talk to Mortimer Lonzo Littlepaw, if you can get him on the wire."
"What do you want from him?"
"What I said I wanted. I want to ask him about the suicide."
"It was an accident," she said dully.
I detached a bill and held it up. "See that?" I said. "That's $100. I laid it on the table at the end toward her. "Look at it good," I said. "It's yours. Pick it up." She looked fearfully at the bill. I held up two more bills. "Two more," I said, "just like it. $300. If you could put me in touch with Mortimer, the money would be yours."
"The vibrations," she muttered. "Sometimes the vibrations."
"Yeah," I said, "the vibrations. But $100 will do a lot for the vibrations. Pick up that bill. It's yours."
"No," she said quickly and huskily. "No."
I took one of the two bills in my hand and laid it on top of the other one on the table. "Pick it up," I said, "and to hell with the vibrations. Don't you like money? Don't you need money? When did you get a square meal? Pick it up and start talking."
"No,"
she whispered, cringing back against the wall with a hand now on the doorknob as though she might flee, staring at the money. Then she stared at me, thrusting her head out suddenly, saying,
I know you. You're trying to trick me. You're from the insurance company."
"Wrong number," I said. "But I know about Mortimer's insurance policy. Suicide clause. That's why you..." She hissed, and her gaunt face gathered itself into a contortion which might have been grief or rage or despair. You couldn't tell for sure.
"He borrowed on his insurance nearly all and didn't tell me.
So you lied for almost nothing," I said. "You collected the insurance all right, but there wasn't much left to collect."
"No," she said, "there wasn't. He left me that way. He didn't tell me.
He left me with nothing, and this...
She looked about the room, the broken furniture, the foulness, and seemed to shudder and shrink from it as though she had just entered and perceived it.
This, she said. This.
300 would help, I said, and nodded toward the two bills on the velvet.
This, she said. He left me. He was a coward. Oh, it was easy for him. Easy. All he had to do was...
Was to jump, I finished. That quieted her. She looked at me heavily for a long moment, then said,
He didn't jump.
My dear Miss Littlepaw, I said in the tone usually described as not unkindly, why don't you admit it? Your brother's been dead a long time, and it'll do him no harm. The insurance company has forgotten about the business. Nobody would blame you for lying. You had to live. And...
It wasn't the money, she said. It was the disgrace. I wanted him buried from the church. I wanted...
She stopped suddenly. Ah, I said and glanced at the holy pictures around the wall.
I was a believer then,
she said, paused, corrected herself.
I believe now in God, but it's different.
Yes, yes, I said soothingly, and looked at the one trumpet left on the table. And of course it's stupid to think of it as a disgrace. When your brother did it...
It was an accident, she said.
Now, Miss Littlepaw, you just admitted the fact a second ago.
It was an accident, she repeated, drawing back into herself.
No, I said, he did it, but it was not his fault. He was driven to it. I watched her face. He had given years to that company, then they threw him out, to make room for a man who had done a wicked thing, who drove your brother to his death. Isn't that true? I got up and took a step toward her. Isn't that true? She looked at me steadily, then broke.
He did. He drove him to it. He killed him. He was hired because it was a bribe. My brother knew that. He told them he knew it, but they threw him out. They said he couldn't prove it and threw him out.
Could he prove it? I said.
Oh, he knew, all right. He knew all about that coal business. He knew long before, but he didn't know what they were going to do to him. They treated him fine then and knew all the time that they'd throw him out, but he went to the governor and said,
What? I demanded. What did you say? And stepped toward her.
To the governor, he...
Who?
To Governor Stanton, and the governor wouldn't listen. He just...
I grasped the old woman's arm and held it tight. Listen, I said. You're telling me that your brother went to Governor Stanton and told him?
Yes, and Governor Stanton wouldn't listen. He wouldn't listen. He told him he couldn't prove anything. He wouldn't investigate, and that...
Are you lying? I demanded and shook the matchwood arm.
It's true, true to God,
she exclaimed, quivering in my grasp.
And that killed my brother. The governor killed him. He went to the hotel and wrote the letter to me and told me, and that night...
The letter, I said. What happened to the letter?
That night, just before day, but waiting all night in that room, and just before day...
The letter, I demanded. What happened to the letter? I shook her again, and she repeated, whispering,
Just before day...
But she came up out of the depth of the thought she was in, looked at me, and answered,
I have it.
I released my grip on her arm, thrust a bill into her clammy hand, and crushed her fingers upon it. It's $100, I said. Give me the letter and you can have the rest. $300.
No, she said. No, you want to get rid of the letter. Because it tells the truth, you're that man's friend.
She stared into my face, prying into it, blinking, like an old person prying with feeble fingers to open a box. She gave up and asked helplessly,
Are you his friend?
If he could see me right now, I said, I don't imagine he would think so.
You aren't his friend?
No, I said. She looked at me dubiously.
No, I said, I'm not his friend. Give me the letter. If it's ever used, it'll be used against him, I swear it.
I'm afraid,
she said, but I could feel her fingers under my arm slowly working the bill I had thrust there. Don't be afraid of the insurance company, that was long back.
When I went to the governor,
she began. Did you go to the governor, too?
After it happened, after everything, I wanted to hurt that man, I went to the governor.
My God, I said.
And asked him to punish him, because he'd taken a bribe, because he had killed my brother. But he said I had no proof that that man was his friend, and I had no proof.
The letter, did you show him the letter?
Yes, I had the letter.
Did you show Governor Stanton the letter?
Yes, yes. And he stood there and said, Miss Littlepaw, you have sworn that you did not receive that letter. You have sworn to a lie, and that's perjury, and the penalty for perjury is severe. And if that letter becomes known, you will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
What did you do? I asked. The head, which was nothing but gray hair and yellow skin stuck on bone, and old memories, wavered on its thin stalk of a neck, lightly and dryly, as though touched by a breeze.
Do,
she echoed.
Do,
shaking her head.
I was a poor woman, alone. My brother, he had gone away. What could I do?
You kept the letter, I affirmed, and she nodded.
Get it, I said, get it.
Nobody will bother you now, I swear it. She got it. She clawed into the mass of yellow and acid-smelling papers and old ribbons and crumpled cloth in a tin trunk in the corner while I leaned over her and fretted at the palsied incompetence of the fingers. Then she had it. I snatched the envelope from her hand and shook the paper out. It was a sheet of hotel stationery. The Hotel Moncastello, dated August 3, 1915, I read, Dear Sister, I have been this afternoon to see Governor Stanton and told him how I have been thrown out of my job like a dog after all these years because that man Irwin was bribed to let up on the suit against the Southern Bell Fuel people and how he now has my place at a salary they never paid me, and I gave them my heart's blood all these years. And they call him Vice President, too. They lied to me and they cheated me and they make him Vice President for taking a bribe. But Governor Stanton would not listen to me. He asked me for my proof, and I told him what Mr. Satterfield told me months ago, how the case had been fixed, and how in our company they'd take care of Irwin. Now Satterfield denies it. He denies he ever told me, and looks me in the eye. So I have no proof, and Governor Stanton will not investigate. I can do no more. I went, as you know, to the people who are against Governor Stanton in politics, but they would not listen to me. Because that blackguard and infidel McCall, who is their kingpin, is tied up with Southern Bell. At first they were interested, but now they laugh at me. What can I do? I'm old and not well. I'll never be any good again. I'll be a drag on you and not a help.
What can I do, sister?
You've been good to me, I thank you. Forgive me for what I'm going to do, but I'm going to join our sainted mother and our dear father, who were kind and good to us, and who will meet me on the other shore and dry every tear. Goodbye until the happy day when we shall meet again in light. Mortimer. P.S. I have borrowed against my insurance a good bit, on account of bad investments. But there's something left, and if they know I've done what I'm going to do, they'll not pay you. P.S. Give my watch, which was father's, to Julian, who will respect it, even if he is only a cousin. P.S. I could do what I'm going to do easier if I were not trying to get the insurance for you. I've paid for the insurance, and you ought to have it. So the poor bastard had gone to the other shore, where mother and father would dry away every tear, immediately after having instructed his sister how to defraud the insurance company. There it all was, all of Mortimer Lonzo, the confusion, weakness, piety, self-pity, small-time sharpness, vindictiveness, all of it in that neat, spidery, old-fashioned bookkeeper sort of hand, a little shakier than ordinary, perhaps, but with all the T's crossed and the I's dotted.
I replaced it in the envelope and put it in my pocket. "I'm going to have it photostated," I said, "and you may have it back. I'll have the photostat certified. But you must make a statement before a notary about your visit to Governor Stanton, and..." I went over to the table and picked up the two bills and handed them to her. "There'll be another one coming to you after you make your statement. Get your hat." So I had it after all the months. For nothing is lost, nothing is ever lost. There's always the clue, the canceled check, the smear of lipstick, the footprint in the canna bed, the condom on the park path, the twitch in the old wound, the baby shoes dipped in bronze, the taint in the bloodstream. And all times are one time, and all those dead in the past never lived before our definition gives them life, and out of the shadow their eyes implore us. That's what all of us historical researchers believe. And we love truth. Chapter 6. It was late March in 1937 when I went to see Miss Littlepaw in the foul, fox-smelling lair in Memphis and came to the end of my researches. I'd been on the job almost 7 months, but other things had happened during that period besides my researches. Tom Stark, a sophomore, had made quarterback on the mythical All-Southern 11 and had celebrated by wrapping an expensive yellow sport job around a culvert on one of the numerous new speedways which bore his father's name. Fortunately, a highway patrol car and not some garrulous citizen discovered the wreck, and the half-empty bottle of evidence was, no doubt, flung into the night to fall in the dark waters of the swamp. Beside the unconscious form of the sophomore Thunderbolt lay another form, conscious but badly battered, for in the big yellow expensive sport job Tom had had with him a somewhat less expensive yellow-headed sport job named, it turned out, Caress Jones. So Caress wound up in the operating room of the hospital and not in the swamp. She obligingly did not die, though in the future she never would be much of an asset in a roadster. But her father was less obliging. He stamped and swore that he was going to have blood, and breathed indictments, jail, publicity, and lawsuits. His fires, however, were pretty soon banked. Not that it didn't cost some nice change, but in the end the whole transaction was conducted without noise. Mr. Jones was in the trucking business, and somebody pointed out to him that trucks ran on state roads, and that truckers had a lot of contacts with certain state departments. Tom wasn't hurt a bit, though he lay up in the hospital unconscious for 3 hours while the boss, pale as a starched sheet and with his hair hanging and his eyes wild and sweat running down his cheeks, paced the floor of the waiting room and ground one fist into the palm of the other hand while his breath made a labored sound, like the breath of his son in the room beyond. Then Lucy Stark got there. It was about 4 in the morning then. Her eyes red but tearless and a stunned look on her face. They had quite a row, but that was after the word had come out that Tom was all right. Up till then he had paced the floor breathing hard and she had sat and stared straight into the blackness. But when the word came, she got up and went over to stand before him and say, "You must stop him." Her voice was scarcely above a whisper. He stood there staring heavily, uncomprehendingly into her face, then put one hand out to touch her like a bear touching something with a clumsy exploratory paw, and said through dry lips, He's going to be all right, Lucy. He's all right." She shook her head. "No," she said, "he's not all right." "The doctor," he took a lurching step toward her, "the doctor said..." "No, he's not all right," she repeated, "and won't be, unless you make him." The blood suddenly flushed heavily into his cheeks. "Now look here, if you mean stopping football, if you..." That was an old story between them. "Oh, it's not just football. That's bad enough, thinking he's a hero, that there's nothing else in the world, but it's everything that goes with it. He's wild and selfish and idle, and no boy of mine's going to be a sissy now. That's what you want. I would rather see him dead at my feet than what your vanity will make him." "Don't be a fool. You will ruin him."
Her voice was quiet and even.
Hell, let him be a man. I never had any fun growing up. Let him have some fun. I want him to have some fun. I used to see people having fun and never had any. I want him to...
You will ruin him, she said, with her voice as quiet and even as...